Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 1, The First Step in God Realization, Text Number 12. Translation: what is the value of a prolonged life which is wasted, inexperienced, by years in this world? Better a moment of full consciousness, because that gives one a start in searching after his supreme interest. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Srila Shukadev Goswami instructed Maharaj Parikshit about the importance of chanting the holy name of the Lord by every progressive gentleman, in order to encourage the king, who had only 7 remaining days of life. Srila Shukadev Goswami asserted that there is no use in living hundreds of years without any knowledge of the problems of life. Better to live for a moment with full consciousness of the supreme interest to be fulfilled. The supreme interest of life is eternal with full knowledge and bliss. Those who are bewildered by the external features of the material world and are engaged in the animal propensities of the eat, drink, and be merry type of life are simply wasting their lives by the unseen passing away of valuable years. We should know in perfect consciousness that human life is bestowed upon the conditioned soul to achieve spiritual success, and the easiest possible procedure to attain this end is to chant the holy name of the Lord. In the previous verse, we have discussed this point to a certain extent, and we may further be enlightened on the different types of offenses committed unto the feet of the holy name. Srila Jiva Goswami Prabhu has quoted many passages from authentic scriptures and has ably supported the statements in the matter of offenses at the feet of the holy name. From the Vishnu Yamala Tantra, Sri Jiva Goswami has proven that one can be liberated from the effects of all sins simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord. Quoting from the Markandeya Purana, Sri Goswamiji says that one should neither blaspheme the devotee of the Lord nor indulge in hearing others who are engaged in belittling a devotee of the Lord. A devotee should try to restrict the vilifier by cutting out his tongue. And being unable to do so, one should commit suicide rather than hear the blaspheming of a devotee of the Lord. The conclusion is that one should neither hear nor allow vilification of a devotee of the Lord. As far as distinguishing the Lord's holy name from the names of the demigods, the revealed scriptures disclose in the Bhagavad Gita 10:41 that all extraordinarily powerful beings are but parts and parcels of the supreme energetic Lord Krishna. Except for the Lord himself, everyone is subordinate. No one is independent of the Lord. Since no one is more powerful than or equal to the energy of the Supreme Lord, no one's name can be as powerful as that of the Lord. By chanting the Lord's holy name, one can derive all the stipulated energy synchronized from all sources. Therefore, one should not equalize the supreme holy name of the Lord with any other name. Brahma, Shiva, or any powerful god can never be equal to the Supreme Lord Vishnu. The powerful holy name of the Lord can certainly deliver one from sinful effects. But one who desires to utilize this transcendental potency of the holy name of the Lord in one's sinister activities is the most degraded person in the world. Such persons are never excused by the Lord or by any agent of the Lord. One should therefore utilize one's life in glorifying the Lord by all means without any offense. such activity of life, even for a moment, is never to be compared to a prolonged life of ignorance, like the lives of the tree and other living entities who may live for thousands of years without prosecuting spiritual advancement. Kim pramattasya bahuvihi parokshayar hayanayariha varam muhurtam virittam kartate sreyase yataha. What is the value of a prolonged life which is wasted, inexperienced by years in this world? Better a moment of full consciousness, because that gives one a start in searching after his supreme interest. So here, Sukadeva Goswami speaks of this in the next verse to encourage Maharaj Parikshit. He's just spoken that the way of success for all classes of people is Harera Namanu Kirtanam, the chanting the holy name of the Lord. This is the Nirnitam, the decided conclusive truth. And now, to encourage him in the activity of he's saying this. I think this verse and the next two, talking about alluding to the fact that now Maharaj Parikshit has a very short time left to him, 7 days. And he shouldn't be discouraged that just because you have only 7 days, you can't accomplish anything. And these 7 days, he said, are more important, or could be more important than the rest of all your life put together. It depends on how you live it, how you use your time, not the quantity of time. So there can be, what's the use of, he's saying here in this verse, what's the use of many years in this world for those who are bewildered and actually do not have any real experience. People have so many years, but at least to one who's on the platform of Krishna consciousness, those who are materialists, it looks to us as though they're not even living their own lives. They're like ghosts. They're sort of floating through the world, but they're not really doing anything. They're practically not there. So better a moment of vidittam, consciousness or deliberate awareness of what you're supposed to be doing, spent in the shreyase, in the supreme interest. You know, here's a place where this word is very important. There's a distinction, prayas and shreyas. Praya meaning some immediate benefit, and shreya means long-term or ultimate benefit or interest. Shreyase, in your supreme interest, meaning the interest of Krishna consciousness. Now here, Prabhupada alludes to the bewildered people as those who are bewildered by the external features of the material world and are engaged in the animal propensities of the eat, drink, and be merry type of life. They're simply wasting their lives by the unseen passing away of valuable years. You know the eat, this is the slogan, eat, drink, and be merry. What's the rest of it? For tomorrow we die. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So this is a common exhortation actually to sense gratification. And there's this, I picked up some things from English literature. We can have a little English course here. Because Prabhupada is, in a way, it's the same sort of thing, but he uses it to a different purpose. Tomorrow we die, therefore what should we do? Well, it's not eat, drink, and be merry. But in literature, not just English literature, but European literature, there's a standard theme, which is called in Latin, carpe diem. C-A-R-P-E, but it's pronounced carpe. Carpe diem. It means seize the day. Usually it shows up in seduction poems or love poetry. So here's one, for example, this is Ben Jonson, contemporary Shakespeare. Come, my Celia, let us prove, that is experience, let us prove, while we can, the sports of love. Of course, in those days, prove and love rhymed. Time will not be ours forever. He at length our good will sever. Spend not then his gifts in vain. Suns that set may rise again, but if once we lose this light, 'tis with us perpetual night. Why should we defer our joys? So on. This is the standard one. Here's another one, Robert Carrick, to the virgins to make much of time. This is a famous one. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Old time is still a-flying, and the same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying. The glorious lamp of heaven, the sun, the higher he's a-getting, the sooner will his race be run, and nearer he's to setting. And so on, you know. But the most famous of these, I think, and the greatest one by Andrew Marvel, is called To His Coy Mistress. Coy means she's not, you know, putting out like he wants. And this one begins, had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, would be no crime. And then he goes on about how they could just take everything at a leisurely pace. But he says, but at my back I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near, and yonder all before us lie deserts of the vast eternity. Thy beauty shall no more be found, nor in thy marble vault shall sound my echoing song. Your tomb, your marble vault. Then, that is when she's dead, then the worms shall try that long preserved virginity, and your quaint honor turn to dust, and in the ashes all my lust. The grave's a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there embrace. That's a good, huh? Now we have the right Krishna consciousness stuff. Yes, this is evil literature, folks. Trying to persuade people to engage in sense gratification. But here we have Shukadev Goswami, again noticing that time is passing, the time is short, and it's the same thing, carpe diem, seize the day. What you should use it for, self-realization. You can get the value out of this, not for sense gratification, because here they're saying, this eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, people are just an excuse for it. Wasting their time. And Prabhupada said they engage in that, and then there's the Haribol. Then there's the unseen passing of valuable years. Takes place. What does he mean by unseen passing away of valuable years? People are engaged, let's live for the moment. Each day the moment comes, and then suddenly there are no more moments. And what happened to my time? It disappeared, it vanished, it's gone. So that's this exhortation here, this seize the day, this carpe diem. Now, you only have 7 days, you have such little bit of time, but naturally you're not actually at a loss. He's saying, Prabhupada here talks about, here it starts about one gets a start in searching after that supreme interest. But we'll see this develops. And then one can actually achieve not just get a start, but you can accomplish everything in a moment. This is the word muhurta, just like we say, Brahma muhurta. You know. In just a short time, one can achieve everything. So then Prabhupada continues the discussion here about the offenses against the holy name. We saw yesterday, in yesterday's verse, where Shukadeva Goswami was speaking about the constant chanting of the holy name, and there Prabhupada has a discussion of the offenses. So now he continues. You know, sometimes that, you know, Prabhupada's, sometimes a single theme will go through many, many purports. You know, it's like a continuous essay span across a number of purports. So here he's been citing Jiva Goswami. That's of course because Prabhupada has Jiva Goswami's commentary on the Bhagavatam in front of him, and he's picking from the different acharyas, and so he's mentioning how Jiva Goswami's quoted all these different passages and so on from different texts about the chanting. So Prabhupada, he's already gone through every single offense, but now he comes back to mention a couple of more. One is the offense of blaspheming the devotees. Here where it says that a devotee should try to restrict the vilifier by cutting out his tongue. According to time, place, and circumstance, it's usually not a good idea. This particular line has been used against us by our enemies, who say that we're inciting people to violence. So it's just meant, what's meant here is that one should take this very, very seriously. So it says, you cut out his tongue, or being able to do so, one should commit suicide. That's also not recommended. What's recommended is one leave the place. Another place, that's the other option. One should leave the place, one should stop one's ears. But at any rate, it shouldn't be taken place. Why is blaspheming the devotees an offense against the holy name? Why isn't it just an offense against the devotees? Because it is. It's Vaishnava aparad. You're offending the devotees. Is that bad enough? No. You know, it's why this is one where you hit two targets with one offense. You kill two birds with one stone. You manage to not only commit Vaishnava aparad, but every time we commit Vaishnava aparad, we also commit Nama aparad at the same time. So this is one of these very, very difficult offenses. And unfortunately, it's one to which people are extremely prone in our Krishna consciousness movement. And we should discuss this proneness. The reason it's also nama-aparad is that because the Vaishnavas in question are Vaishnavas who are actually servants of the holy name. And they because we say dedicated their lives to propagating the holy name of the Lord. So they become servants of the holy name. Now the holy name is none different from Krishna. But still, although it's none different from Krishna, it is a form of, he's a form of Krishna which has certain features of Krishna are particularly manifest. We learned this yesterday, where it says, Prabhupada says, Srila Jiva Goswami instructs the chanting of the holy name of the Lord should be loudly done. And it should be performed offenselessly as well, as recommended in the Padma Purana. Now, he says, one can deliver himself from the effects of all sins by surrendering himself to the Lord. One can deliver himself from all offenses at the feet of the Lord by taking shelter of his holy name. One cannot protect himself if one commits an offense at the feet of the holy name of the Lord. So notice what it says here, that although the Lord and the Lord's name are the same, still they're particular features or energies of Krishna which are differently manifest in different forms of Krishna. So if one surrenders to Krishna, as it's said at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, one can become free from all sins. But what stops us from surrendering to Krishna is offenses at the feet of the Lord. It's not the sins that stop us, but it's offenses. They're two different things, sins and offenses, sometimes. So how do I get rid of the offenses? Then I have to approach the other form of the Lord, Nam Prabhu, the Lord in the form of his name. Then I can be delivered of offenses, which then help me to become free, to surrender fully to Krishna and become more and more free from sins in all its forms, including the form of even the desire to commit sins. Now this is the special feature but then if I blaspheme the devotees, then that's an offense against the holy name. That's the next thing. The difference between sins and offenses is that, of course, any time that we're committing sins, that also tends to be an offense. Like, for example, any sin is a disobedience of the order of the spiritual master. So you commit that sin, you're also offending the spiritual master. So sins are generally offenses, although sometimes something can be completely accidental that doesn't constitute an offense or much of one. But an offense is not necessarily a sin. One thing is, we know, like for example in Kali Yuga, at any rate, that if you commit a sin mentally, there's no reaction. You're absolved of the reaction. But if you do something pious mentally, you get a pious reaction. You just, you know, think you would like to do something pious. But if you get the idea of killing somebody, and say, "Nah, I can't do that." You don't do it, or prevented from doing it. In a previous age, you know, you suffered a reaction for just having that murderous thought, a sinful reaction. Now you don't get a reaction because, you know, who would? But actually, many offenses are mental. To consider the spiritual master an ordinary person, you don't even have to open your mouth or do anything. Just think. We just think it. That's an offense. And it's just as heavy, you know, it's a heavy offense. Consider the names of the demigods be equal to. These are mental. Now that's not necessarily a sin as far as the karmakanda portion of the Vedas is considered anyway. Consider the names of the demigods to be equal to or independent of the holy name of Vishnu. That's not a I mean, that'd be like a sinful reaction for doing, but it's definitely an offense. So that you have to understand there, although there's overlap, they're not entirely the same also. So one has to be very careful. In other words, we're not even supposed to have bad thoughts about the Vaishnavas, let alone speak it or punch somebody in the nose. Now, why is this? Because here's the holy name. Here's the holy name who is very, very magnanimous, merciful feature of Krishna, where you can, you know, you've offended Krishna, you can go to the holy name, you know, and so on. I mean, it's just, so these are, then, here are the people who are the servants of the holy name, delivering the holy name everywhere. And so if we offend the servants, then the master's offended. And more so than if even in, you know. So, now you may say, but see, here's the tricky part that I've noticed in ISKCON. If somebody has done some service in spreading the holy name of the Lord, now let's say he's a creep. I mean, let's say he has bad manners, and, you know, let's say he's got so many faults. Nevertheless, he's done this duty for the holy name. He's actually distributed the holy name. Now, what my experience is that Krishna, Namprabhu, doesn't care that he's a creep. He looks at the service and says, look what this person has done for me. You see? So it is no excuse to say that when I find fault with a devotee, that the devotee actually has faults. It's worse if I make them up. I mean, they're different way. One. Let's say there's a real fault. Now, fault finding means that my attention is attracted to that fault. Here's the person who's got, you know, many, many credits as a servant of the holy name. But somehow or other, that doesn't draw my interest as the way that the fault draws my interest. So I'm interested in the fault. I'm not interested in all the good things this person has done. I'm interested in the fault. Now it's a real fault. But the thing about my interest in this fault is that I'll think about it over and over and over again, and therefore it starts to gain an exaggerated importance in my mind. And so then I'll start to, then I'm starting to make a fiction, because this fault has become exaggerated in its importance and significance. And then because of that, I'll start to see it where it's not really there. You know. Because once the fault-finding mentality is there, then I start to look for it. That's my expectation. Now I expect something's going to happen, and then it will happen. Then I become a fault-finder. So that propensity, I mean, that can happen. Now, the origin of fault finding is particularly devastating and problem, because to my mind, it really, from what I can see, is at the root of the common experience of people, that when they begin to chant the holy name of Krishna and they take up the process of Krishna consciousness, they get an immediate rush of spiritual advancement. You know, and it's, wow, this is so far out. And then they begin to get more and more, and then all of a sudden, boom, you know, the express elevator stops or slows to a crawl. And that immediate rush of Krishna consciousness, of help for Krishna consciousness, stops. Why was it like that? It doesn't have to be like that, but many people, this is a common experience. People always ask me, why does this happen? And the reason it happens is that in the beginning, one was not committing offenses, and especially offending the Vaishnavas, because that's the easiest one. Because what we see all the time is people who have begun to come into contact with Krishna consciousness, in their ignorance, they think that all the devotees who live in the temple and are practicing Krishna consciousness are great souls, right? Because then they don't know anybody very well. They're idealizing Krishna consciousness, and they don't deal with them on a day-to-day basis, you know. And they don't know that this great soul never cleans the sink, you know, or never picks up his towel or whatever, you know. Or even has bigger, but they idealize the devotee. They think everyone's a great soul. And then what happens, they get to know people better. And just that, and then, you know, then there's the familiarity breeds contempt. You get familiar, you get a little casual, you forget who you're dealing with. Even you may be dealing with a great devotee. There's an old English saying, you know, that no man is a hero to his valet, you know, one that polishes his shoes and his personal servant and sees all the little defects. This is the danger. Sometimes it's better not to get too close to people. And so that, therefore, one can in the first place just become careless or just irritated, you know, the general friction of people braiding each other over the course of the day, and we just forget that you're dealing with servants of the holy name. There's a special category of people. And unfortunately, if one has a tendency to make friends with devotees on a material platform, that is, I like this devotee, we get along together, and we discover we have a common interest in, you know, martial arts or something, you know, something that's not really related to Krishna consciousness that we like, whether it's martial arts or samosas or something, you know, it's just some material interest that's there. Then we form a friendship on a material basis. The problem with that is that having formed a friendship on a material basis, you're liable to forget that this is a devotee and then commit Vaishnava aparadha when, you know, the guy suddenly does something to you you don't like. Because with the friendship, with friends, comes enemies. And the same guy who's, you know, a friend in January can very easily become an enemy in February. So that's one problem with this, committing offenses. And then, when that happens, then all of a sudden, the same potency isn't there when we take shelter of the holy name. One can understand that if that potency isn't there, that there are offenses going on. This is the very common one. Then another thing that happens when fault finding gets really bad is when it's really, you know, a concealment. That is to say, when I start to find fault with others, is I'm doing this as a substitute for dealing with my own faults. I myself, what I'm really worried about is me. I have got this fault, that fault, that fault, the other fault. But I don't honestly want to deal with that. Rather, I want to save, I know I have all these faults, but still I want to save my pride and my self-esteem by saying I'm a great devotee. Yet in my heart I'm still worried. When I'm in that kind of frame of mind, that's when I really notice everybody else's faults. Because this way I'm assuring myself I'm not so bad, he's worse. That's what's going on. Well, I may secretly think, oh, I do this wrong, you know, I do that wrong, I do that wrong. But look at that guy. And then the worse I secretly feel about myself, the more my tendency is to say, this guy, this guy, this guy. And then the next thing, and of course our classic example of that, I mean this is such a big problem, it shows up right in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. Ramachandra Puri. Right? Classical, this is such a, because this, you know where this becomes a problem? This becomes a problem in any religious tradition that has got high standards. Krishna consciousness has got high standards. In fact, they're so high that nobody really thinks they're living up to them. It's not that the Mahabhagavata thinks, you know, now I'm living up to all the principles of Krishna consciousness. The Mahabhagavata thinks everybody else is living up to them but me. So the standards are so high that actually nobody, absolutely no one thinks I've achieved perfection, except the fools. No one thinks that, you know. So there's always a difference by what we think we ought to be and what we are, right? So you have this, the problem that we're dealing with here is not the problem that, you know, here's what we should be and here's what we are. That itself is not the problem. The problem is, how do we deal with that difference? And fault finding comes in when we don't deal with it honestly. That is to say, we are concealing this difference from ourselves and from other people. So Ramachandra Puri wanted to be a great devotee. Now he failed in the major thing, his relationship with his spiritual master. His spiritual master was having his final pastimes, and he came and he basically gave him instruction, because Madhavendra Puri was in the mood of separation from Krishna. He was in Radharani's mood of separation and was lamenting that I have not attained Krishna. Ramachandra Puri says, why are you lamenting the Sotsi Krishna? You should be on the platform of Prabhupada. He didn't understand at all. You know, he was obviously contaminated by Mayavad philosophy and didn't understand the platform of Madhavendra Puri, which is typically, you see, when you're somebody who's very, very higher than you are, and you don't understand them, you think, oh, there's, people do this with Prabhupada all the time. You know, he said something about social issues, it's, oh, it's so old-fashioned, and think, you know, they don't understand, he's way, way ahead, rather than, so in this way, he was lamenting in transcendental feelings of separation, and you know, Ramachandra Puri couldn't understand, and so, you know, he was rejected by his spiritual master. Here he is, major failure. So what does he do? He goes around and says, "Your people are eating too much." That becomes his whole crusade. You know, he goes to Puri, and it says that what he used to do is he criticized all the followers of Lord Chaitanya that too much into food. And it said that his method was, he would sit down and he would induce somebody to eat too much, and then afterwards criticize. He said, "Do you see how much he ate?" You know. You know, this was his, and of course, even the same thing with Lord Chaitanya. He instructed Lord Chaitanya, "You're a sannyasi. You know, you go to all these people; they feed you so much. You know, what are you, a sannyasi? What are you, such a, you know, filling your belly all the time? This is not what we're supposed to be doing. Blah blah blah. You know, this is Rama. You know." Now he was a big fault finder. What was behind the fault, you see? Why was he doing this? You see? Because on this area, now he could feel I'm a great devotee. And because what he couldn't deal with and wasn't going to deal with, the main fact, so what he was rejected by his spiritual master. But now he's coming to Lord Chaitanya, you know, I'm the godbrother of your spiritual master, so now you have to treat me. I'm Guru Varga, gave him instructions and all that. So there you see it. I mean, it's right there. You know, that tendency, not to be honest about our own misgivings, and therefore, really, you know, when we're talking about other people, what we're really talking about is ourselves. So you see a fault finder. You know, really, you know, you should just understand there's a big neon guilty sign hanging around his neck, you know, because you point your finger at somebody, there's three fingers pointing back at you. This is really what's going on. It's about yourself. That's why when I see all these people, you know, talk about ISKCON this, ISKCON that, you know, That's all autobiography. They're talking about themselves, because you look at these rich big people and all these other guys who are going on and on and on about how, you know, this con is dead and all this other kind of stuff. That's like saying, I'm dead. Nobody can make spiritual advancement in ISKCON. I'm not making any spiritual advancement. They're talking about themselves. This is not to say that ISKCON doesn't have faults. That's not the point. But it's sometimes your fault finding, you're looking at people's real faults. But what's been manufactured out of it is the other thing. So these things, we have to learn the art of not committing offenses. It's in our own self-interest, because as long as we're not trying to become free from offenses, then the holy names, potencies will not work. You can go on chanting. How can you go on chanting for millions of births and not go anywhere? Here, Shukadeva Goswami says, you know, 7 days is plenty of time. And yet, you can go on chanting for many lives and not make any progress. What's the difference? Now, the difference is the quality of that chanting. So one has to be on the clearing platform. And the clearing platform is chanting while trying to become free from offenses. And you see, when there's this fault finding with this kind of concealment going on, you're not trying to become free from offenses. You think you're in this deluded condition, you think you're making spiritual progress by finding fault. I'm sure Ramachandrapuri thought he was benedicting everybody. He thought he was, you know, helping everyone make spiritual progress, therefore he is making spiritual progress. He was really digging himself deeper into the hole. Well, that's a problem with that one. We have to stop. Maybe a moment? Question or comment? Yeah?
It's like a very dangerous thing when the fault that you are looking at affects devotees and criticism of devotees. If you have so easy to dig yourself in a hole by noticing the fault, you know what you're actually seeing. So how do you...
Well, some of us, it's not that you're supposed to be an idiot. It's easy in the very beginning not to see faults, because maybe you're really naive and stupid, although in some ways it's spiritually advantageous. But it doesn't mean that after you've been in the movement, and you also have to discriminate. You know, I should associate with this person, I should avoid that person, right? So it's not that you're supposed to, you know, somehow, you know, hear no evil, see no evil, you know, so on, and become a fool and not be able to discriminate between devotees. So that you have to do. But at the same time, one has to see these faults in the right perspective. One has to be compassionate. Anyway, if we're actually honest and open about ourselves, and as Prabhupada said, the first place to exercise the fault-finding propensity is with ourselves. If we're doing that, if we're honest about ourselves, then we won't actually fall into this this trap. And when we see shortcomings and difficulties of other devotees, first of all, it should be seen in the light of everything else. One should take as what a devotee is. Well, what he really is what he's trying to become. That we, you know, his goal, his aim, his effort, what he wants to be, and therefore, as a general rule, our activity should be as people's genuine well wishers. When one is a fault finder, you are not actually wishing people well. So one stays a well-wisher. And then some of us are in a position where it's your duty to find fault. Managers, temple presidents, spiritual masters, GBCs, that's your job. You're supposed to notice the faults. If you don't notice the faults, you know, people will really get on your case. Because it's your job to rectify discrepancies and things like that. But that's a different thing from fault-finding. And so the real faults and shortcomings of people are there. But people are looking to use that as an excuse, you know. All the devotees have so many faults, that's good, because I don't really have to try so hard, you know, to become Krishna conscious myself now. We're using it as an excuse. Anything else? Pujari's not here, what's happening? Here we go. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.